through Mr. Stroms on the bill from last year that we, or actually this year that we passed, and then the finance reform proposal that we most want to hear from you on. We're very, very excited about. It's an outcropping from the Governor's Task Force on Education Finance and then the PS Minnesota Task Force on Education Finance and then the bipartisan Senate House Education Finance Reform Task Force that was signed by all 10 members, all Republicans and Democrats on the task force signed it. And we introduced it at the end of session. Commissioner Segrin also worked on the report with us. And the general goal is to simplify funding and make it more fair, reduce property taxes, and make sure there's adequate funding so students graduate from high school ready for success. We have a higher base formula. We fully fund special ed. There's more equity and fairness in the formula between districts. And the formula, once it's fair and equitable, is linked to inflation so that it doesn't atrophy like many people in the room know that it has done. We also fund the differing student district needs and the district student needs that are present in our district based on the consulting reports from PS Minnesota and the Governor's Task Force. And so that means that we address things like transportation and also in building maintenance. And we also have some flexibility in this plan for early childhood, even though this is a K-12 report. The Early Childhood Committee is hoping to work on one as well. And then finally, this is a scalable proposal, which I kind of like to liken it to the Eiffel Tower. It's a work of art. Everything works together. And you can have a small model or the original size or somewhere in between. But we're not just going to do this part or that part and not other parts first. We're going to do all the parts, and it's a question as to how it's funded and how well it's funded as to how big it gets, but all the parts will work in tandem because otherwise we wouldn't achieve the equitable fairness that we're looking for. So with that, I'm going to call on Mr. Strom to go through the handout that you got at the door. And if you didn't get any of the handouts, if you missed those, they're over there by the table. Mr. Strom.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Mr. Cole, I'm going to go to the podium and use the PowerPoint there, I think.
Oh, great. Okay.
I'm Tim Strom from House Research. I'm a staff person with the House. I've been there about 25 years now. And this is Greg Crow. He's with the House Fiscal Analysis Department. We work for all 134 members of the legislature, primarily on K-12 financing issues. And after the ANOCA hearing, I think the idea is for us to speed things up a bit. So what we'd like to do is spend about 5 minutes reviewing what happened this last legislative session and then spending about 20 minutes running through the highlights of House File 4178. What we're showing you on the PowerPoint is also available on the web. If you simply go to the House website and search the bill number, House File 4178, you'll find the bill, you'll find a couple of proposed amendments. The printouts are listed there, a bill summary is listed there as well. So don't be too concerned about the paper products, or if you're seeing something on the screen that's too small to read, you can at your own leisure go to the House website and just do a search on House File 4178 and you'll find these documents. Why don't we do it this way? I'll very quickly talk about the highlights from this past year that affect the next school year, and then Mr. Crow will talk about the changes that affect years after fiscal year 2009. Just very quickly, primarily the main thing that school folks are interested in is what happened to the general ed funding. For fiscal year 2009, $51 per pupil unit was added across the board to each district in the state. There's a printout in your packet that shows that. It's pretty boring in the right-hand column because it says $51 per pupil for every district. And you can see, based on the current pupil counts, how much money that is for each district. That amounts to about 1% of the basic formula allowance, so it's as if the legislature added another percent to the formula allowance or thereabouts. Secondly, the legislature authorized a one-time fund transfer of up to $51 per pupil unit from your capital account to your general fund. This is more likely to be of interest to smaller districts. Most districts in the metro area, whether it's in their capital fund or their general fund, isn't going to make much difference. So I don't expect many metro districts are going to take advantage of that transfer. Third, there was a lease levy authority that school districts have for those that lease a fair amount of their space. The amount of that levy authority went up from $100 to $150 per pupil unit. Then there were a couple of smaller levy provisions. There were some districts that were participating in local collaborative time study programs. Due to a federal audit, some of those funds were being lost, and this levy authority allows school districts to replace the money that they otherwise would have lost. Finally, the last thing I'd mentioned that passed for a levy this fall that we're still unsure of the details of, passed as part of the first tax bill, was a provision that allows school districts to create a trust and a levy for certain retiree health insurance costs. The department has assigned a fiscal cost to this of about $13 million. We think that may be a little low. We'll see where that comes in. But essentially what that does is it allows school districts to put those cost obligations into a trust, sell bonds to fund the trust, and then annually levy to repay that. So for districts that have high future retiree costs, particularly those health insurance costs, this will probably provide them some budget relief.
The other provision that will affect school districts' general fund budgets begins in fiscal 2010, and later the legislature removed the reduction on of districts' general fund revenue. Under current law, their general fund revenue is reduced by the amount of permanent school fund revenue that they receive. So what that amounts to is there's about $30 million transferred to districts from the permanent school fund, and then their general fund aid is reduced by that amount. By eliminating that reduction, that $30 million will show up as new revenue for school districts starting in fiscal 2010 and will continue and will change based on the returns on the principal in the permanent school fund. That $30 million is paid on a resident pupil basis. So on a resident pupil basis, it's about $36 per pupil of new revenue compared to the $51, which is on a weighted pupil count that we use called AMCPUs. That's a comparable number is about $30 per pupil.
So with that said, if there aren't any questions on legislative actions, we'll move right into House File 4178. There's a couple pages in the PowerPoint that explain the background and goals and characteristics of House File 4178. Representative Greiling just addressed a few of those. Essentially, it's an outgrowth of the task force that was started in 2003. There's a slide in the PowerPoint. You can read about some of that history if you're interested. PS Minnesota essentially was formed to carry on the work of the task force, and they came out with a series of goals and a series of recommendations, and House File 4178 picks up some of those goals and recommendations. You can see those listed on the fifth slide, including adequacy of the funding, making the formulas more equitable, simplifying the funding formula, and providing a way to make it scalable if it's going to be phased in over time. To summarize what's in House File 4178, basically the goal is to set the formula allowance high enough to cover districts' basic instructional needs. So that would mean things that are currently being covered by the referendum and others that are basic instruction would now all be covered by the formula. The formula allowance is set at $7,500 per pupil unit. We use a different definition of pupil in this bill, but essentially that compares to a $5,124 per pupil formula allowance currently. Secondly, on the special ed formulas, the 2007 legislature, primarily at the Senate's instigation in the conference committee, put a tremendous amount of new money that was available into the special ed funding formula. That funding formula, even with all the new money that went into it, is still capped. And as we go out over time for each year, the gap between the amount of your district special ed costs and the amount of revenue is going to be increasing. One of the things this bill does is uncap that, so essentially the formula would cover 68% of your special ed salary costs, regardless how big those are statewide. Third, there are some facility options that are changed. Under current large school districts, are authorized to levy for deferred maintenance needs districts with less than 1.8 million square feet or less than $1.5 million of square feet and buildings that average 35 years of age or older are allowed to levy for deferred maintenance needs without going to the voters, but all the rest of the districts in the state are not. So about 20 districts have that authority right now. One of the provisions of House File 4178 would essentially allow all school boards to levy for deferred maintenance needs without going to the voters. And then finally, the equalizing factors were essentially restored to their levels where they were about 10 years ago. Over time, as those factors haven't changed, the parts of the school funding formula that are based on a mix of aid and levy have become more dependent on levy, and this would essentially restore that that ratio and put more of those levy amounts on the state aid. With that, maybe Mr. Crow wants to run through some of the specific details of the funding formula.
So one of the basic changes that's made is that all students, the pupil count for all students has changed to 1.0. As you're probably aware, under current law, kindergarten students are counted as 0.612 pupil units, and then there are graduated pupil unit counts as you go up through the grades. Different pupil unit counts for grades 1 through 3, then 4 through 6, and then 7 through 12. The proposal in 4168 would end that pupil weighting by grade and change it so that all students would be counted as 1.0, one pupil unit. This does have implications on the formula. For example, the basic formula right now is 5124. If all we did was change the pupil count to 1, that would actually reduce funding to schools. So as you see some of the formulas increasing, part of the increase is just to accommodate the fact that there are fewer students overall in the system. So about 10% of the first change or 10% of the basic formula amount, for example, about $500, that's just to keep the system whole in terms of total overall dollars. So keep that in mind as we talk about the different formulas. And then the current practice of counting students at the district or charter school that they are served and sending the money directly to that district or school continues under 4178. So then on the basic formula allowance, the formula allowance has increased from 5124 to 7,500. And again, part of that increase is from changing pupil weights and so on. And then the formula is also indexed so that each year an inflation factor measured by using the change in gross domestic product implicit price deflator for local and state government services, it is used to inflate the basic formula. So that 7,500, the first or the second year that this bill would be in place would be changed by that inflation rate, and that would adjust each year. Then the next change is in compensatory revenue. As you know, compensatory revenue is used to serve students in students from low socioeconomic backgrounds. What 4178 would do would basically put a floor in so that all students would generate all students eligible for free and reduced lunch meals would generate an additional $2,500 per pupil. And this is different than the current program, which weights those students based on concentration and basically gives a minimum, a floor of that revenue. That $2,500 is 33% of the formula allowance. And then there is still a concentration factor, which increases the maximum revenue to 40% of the formula allowance. And in contrast to current law, where the concentration is calculated for each building site, the concentration would be calculated at the district level rather than at the building level. And the next changes are in the limited English proficiency program, where LEP funding would be linked to the basic formula amount. Under current law, it's a set dollar amount in statute, and that formula amount will be 20% of the basic formula allowance, or 20% of that $7,500. And under current law, there's also a limit that after 5 years, a student who would normally or qualify for LEP funding ceases to generate LEP funding, and that limit would be removed so that as long as the student qualifies, they'll continue to generate revenue. And as it relates to declining enrollment, one of the things that the current funding system does is does a one-year adjustment, as a small adjustment for districts to accommodate their declining enrollment. In other words, they get to count part of their decline as continuing students for the next year. Rather than having that, and that's part of the pupil unit calculation, rather than having that as a part of the pupil unit calculation, House File 4178 would change that to be a separate separate declining enrollment revenue, and that revenue would be calculated as basically a three-year average enrollment for the school district. So obviously if you're growing, it would be your actual enrollment, but if you're declining, you take the previous 3 years and average that enrollment, and that would be the pupil count that would be used to generate the declining enrollment revenue. And then another component of the funding system under House File 4178 is the location equity index. Basically what this does is use cost of living data measured with wage and housing data to adjust or to provide additional revenue to school districts with high cost of living. And so the formula amount for location equity index is 50% of the basic formula allowance, or 50% of the 7,500, or whatever it is for that year, times the county index for the school district. So districts in high-cost counties would receive additional revenue under this special category. And then we also have sparsity revenue under current law. This makes some small changes. Sparsity revenue is provided to small geographically isolated districts. What House File 4178 would do would lower the minimum sparsity district distance from 19 to 15 miles. The calculation for districts receiving sparsity revenue is the distance between the schools, and so by lowering that, you provide additional revenue to districts that qualify. And then there are a few reserves of districts' general fund revenue, general education basic revenue, 1.5% for innovation revenue, 1% for gifted and talented programs, 0.5% for career and technical programs, and the current law reserves for basic skills, operating capital, and staff development are maintained.
There's a few categories of the current formula of general education revenue that are eliminated, and those are listed on slide number 16. Training and experience revenue, equity revenue, the transition revenue, which is a grandfather that basically dates back to changes in the system that were made starting in 1987, relatively small reduction for a pension offset that was put in place in the 1990s. The current formula for gifted and talented of $14 per pupil would be eliminated. However, if you go back to that previous slide, you can see that a reserve of 1% of that basic formula amount set aside for gifted and talented. And then finally, the current funding stream for QComp would be eliminated, and districts wishing to continue that program would be using their regular money, something out of that $7,500 per pupil if they wanted to continue in the QComp program. One last change on the general ed formula. Part of the goal was to eliminate some of the reliance on referendum for basic instructional purposes. So part of that was putting the basic formula up at $7,500 per pupil. A second part of that was to take $500 of each district's referendum authority away and replace it with state aid. So there's a category in the formula that adds $500 for every school district. So in addition to the $7,500, you'll all get an extra $500. But then anyone that has a referendum of over $500 per pupil will lose the first $500 of their referendum. So if you were a district that had a $1,400 referendum, you'd essentially end up with $900 of referendum and an additional $500 of referendum offset revenue. If you were a district with no referendum, you'd end up with an additional $500. So for most of the districts in the state that have referendum authority, it's simply going to be aid for levy. But for those school districts without a referendum, it's an added $500 per pupil. We talked about the special ed change. Basically, you'll get 68% of your special ed costs regardless of a statewide cap. So the formula essentially becomes uncapped. There's a couple of smaller pupil transportation changes. As many of you are probably aware, in 1995, the legislature eliminated categorical funding for transportation purposes. This bill, 4178, restores two transportation funding formulas. The first of those is a hazardous transportation aid, and districts would be able to determine, the school board could determine what conditions in the district are hazardous and would allow busing in those areas. The total amount of that aid could not exceed 20% of the district's total to and from school transportation costs. And then secondly, to help with the costs of bus purchase to buy the new buses, districts would receive essentially 5% of their total transportation costs each year that would be either used for bus purchase or for those districts that contract for their school buses that could be paid for the extra contract costs that are associated with newer school buses. On the facility front, as we mentioned earlier, there's a couple of changes. The primary one is the allowing all districts to levy for deferred maintenance without voter approval. Second, there are some changes and some equalizing factors that will increase the state aid for purposes like the debt service equalization program. And then third, for the rural areas that are reliant on agricultural land, there's an agricultural school bond credit, which essentially offsets the tax on farmlands for building projects at basically two-thirds of the tax. So essentially two-thirds of the building tax that otherwise would have gone against farmland will be picked up and paid for by the state. In terms of the overall effect on property taxes, there'll be some reductions, about $600 million probably, somewhere in that neighborhood because of the changes in the equalizing factors. And secondly, by eliminating some of those levies that currently go with the general ed programs, like the levy for the operating capital, the equity transition, and QComp. And then finally, the biggest share of that levy reduction is by offsetting the $500 per pupil of each district's referendum authority, which is primarily levy statewide. About 80% of that referendum revenue is currently done through the local levy, and 20% comes through the state aid equalization aid. There's a chart that type is too small for me, but if you can blow this up if you look at it on the computer, that essentially shows you how much additional money is going into each of those categories. The amounts are listed in thousands, so you can see, for example, for the basic revenue, the added cost, if House File 4178 were implemented all at once, would be about $1.2 billion. And you can look down that list and see what those other changes amount to. Finally, on the last page, there's just a list with some links to the references that are available on the web. In addition to the references for House File 4178, there's also a link to the guidebooks that Mr. Crow and I put together that explain school finance in some detail. And then finally, there's a link in your folders on the 14-inch paper. There's a printout that shows what the change for each district's revenue is. The first third of that printout essentially shows your current general education aid and referendum revenue per pupil. The second third of the page shows what the proposed amounts would be. And then the last four or five columns show what that change is and how that change affects each school district. There's a lot of ways to measure change. You can measure change in total dollars. You can measure change in total dollars per pupil or as a percentage. Each of those tell a story. Sometimes the story they tell is a little different. If you focus on one kind of change, for instance, the percent increase, you may be missing what's happening on the change over base in total dollars and vice versa. So the idea is to give you several columns there to get some relative feel for how the changes would affect various school districts. So, Madam Chair, that's our abbreviated version of House File 4178.
Thank you very much, Mr. Strom and Mr. Crow. And some of you may know that we have just a limited number, less than what you could count on one hand, of people who understand every aspect of education finance in the state, and we're lucky in the House to have two of those people. They are very, very knowledgeable, very bright, and we could never do what we do without them, that's for sure. There's one more legislator that just arrived. Representative Dietrich, if you'd like to, we just said our names and our city.
Good evening. I'm Denise Dietrich, and I represent District 47A, which is all of Champlin and a portion of Coon Rapids. And you have a very lovely setting here. I drove around it quite often. Nice community.
Those of us who don't come here all the time will be very glad when all this, you know, construction is done. I tried to get here different ways and found myself going south before I could go back north. But luckily, I knew this was going to be challenging. So, Thank you very much. I'm going to turn the meeting over now to Representative McFarland, and I know she's done work to get such a good audience here, and it's been a pleasure to work with her in her first term in the legislature on the K-12 Finance Committee. So, Representative McFarland.
Thank you, Chair Greiling. First of all, I'd like to thank my fellow representatives for being here. I know it's a challenge to get here sometime, and you've come a long way, some of you. I really appreciate it. I'd also like to thank Senator Wieger and Senator Rummel for joining us, too. It's a privilege to have all of you here. This is a school district that I and my husband both graduated from White Bear Schools, and our three children graduated from White Bear. And now we have three grandchildren, two in elementary and one in early childhood. So this is my home, and I, both myself and Senator Rummel served on the White Bear School Board before going to the legislature in 2007. So but it's very exciting to be back here. I just wanted to say a brief thing about the building that we're in. We are celebrating next week at an all-school reunion 150 years of White Bear Schools. I happen to be the president of the Alumni Association also. And this building was built in 1920, this particular section, and you could tell there was a theater right there by the arch in there. So we use our buildings well. We take care of them. And just wanted to bring that up. Let's see what else. Oh, and the other really interesting thing about the history of our school is that we have only had seven superintendents since 1893. And I think that that says a lot about our district. And that is a segue for me to introduce Dr. Ted Blazing, who is going to give a welcome to everybody here and give a brief presentation. And while he's coming forward, I'd like to recognize the school board members from White Bear that are here, if they could rise as being the hosts. We have Chris Heinecker, Greg Larson, Ralph Parsons, Lori Swanson, and Kathy Story is around here also. I want to thank you. Take it away.
Carol said I'm going to bring a welcome. Welcome. Anything else, Carol? I think what we'll do, if it's all right with you, Carol, is we'll launch right into Pete Wilcox and our Executive Director of Business Services, and I have prepared a few remarks. And so while Pete's coming here and setting up our technology, I want all of the Republicans and all of the Democrats to pay close attention. You are seated at a table that is highly nonpartisan. Keep that in mind this evening.
And he's telling the truth.
Pete, as I mentioned, is our Executive Director of Business Services. His pedigree and background speaks for itself. He's led us from, and you'll see in a minute, some very dark times in our financial history to much success. And Pete shares that success and that leadership with those that are seated at that table on Monday evenings. I'm going to mention a little bit about my background only because this evening I'm going to say some things that I would never say. I've been here 15 years, 3 months, and 10 days. So as Carol mentioned, of the seven, I'm one of those. And on June 30, I'm going to step down and try to decide what I'm going to be when I grow up. And so because of that, I feel a bit like a free agent. So I'm going to say some things this evening that I may not normally say in a hearing. I would also point out this. My doctorate is from another Big Ten institution, not the University of Minnesota, just to the south of here, that normally dominates the Gophers in most sports, including football. But my dissertation was on school finance, and specifically the structure of school finance plans and how to balance budgets. And then for 7 years, I was associate superintendent in charge of all the business services in a 20,000-student school district in the state of Iowa. For 4 years in Beloit, Wisconsin, as superintendent, and as I said, the last 15-plus years. So I've got a little bit of perspective on school finance that perhaps others don't have. So, Pete? We're going to tag team you on this one.
We're going to talk a little bit about the financial picture of White Bear Lake.
And it's not being self-serving, because I do believe if you change the years a little bit, you change the numbers a little bit, it's pretty consistent with the story of most school districts across the state of Minnesota. As you'll see shortly, this district has turned itself from a poster child for financial disaster into one that prides itself on financial stability. This could not have been accomplished without the tireless efforts of our superintendent and all district staff, nor without a school board that is unparalleled in its ability to continue to focus on the big picture and make decisions that are in the best interest of our students. Most of all, our community has been extremely supportive of the district by approving both operating levies and a $30 million bond, building bond, to support the growth in the northern part of the district. Now we're going to share about six slides with you. This first slide is one that you've probably seen in many different forms. MDE puts it together for most of the data. But what we have done is gone back to the 92-93 school year. And if you notice, there's three colors, sections. That represents the governor at the time. The pink would be Arne Carlson. The green would be Jesse Ventura. And the yellow is, of course, Governor Pawlenty. It takes the actual change in the formula for White Bear Lake. It's going to be a little different than some of the numbers you'll see from MDE, because every district is impacted just a little bit differently by changes. And it compares it to the CPI for that given year. And if you just take a look at the bottom of this chart, you'll see that the average change in the formula for this 17-year period was 1.5% increase. And the change in the CPI was about 2.7. Obviously, the buying power of our districts have decreased significantly over the 17-year period. This is a slide that our district has been using for about 7 years. Former board members are smiling at this, probably the ones in the audience also. What it really does is a good job of depicting the spring problem that our district and most districts in the state have to go through. When you try and balance financial stability for the district. And why is that important? Well, it allows you to get through some periods of time when funding may not keep up with your expenditures. But from our standpoint, the most critical piece is 75% of our community do not have children in public schools. And this is how they gauge the successfulness of a school district. It's by its financial stability. Obviously, program offerings and class sizes are critical. We try and offer as many programs as we can. We try and keep class sizes as low as we can. And finally, we have to have qualified staff and competitive salaries.
Let me just comment on these. The top one, financial stability, is all about responsibility, and that comes to rest many times right at the table at which you're seated. As Pete said, we're very responsive to our community along that line. The one on the left, program offerings and class size, that's what we're all about. That's our core mission. That's the reason we exist. And then the one on the far right, the top part of that, we'd like to think in terms of excellence, qualified staff. And the second part of it, we strive for mediocrity, competitive salaries. We strive to be the midpoint of the metro area. That's our goal every year in negotiations. We've achieved that and have failed miserably in putting together our budget. And I'll talk more about that in a minute.
I mentioned a moment ago that this district was a poster child for financially troubled districts in the mid-1990s. Through diligent financial management, the district has been able to recover and move into a more successful position. However, this could not only have been achieved because our community has continually stepped up, supported the district's request to generate additional revenues to support the needs of our students. We are now within an eyelash of the maximum level that is allowed by the state for an operating levy. We cannot ask the community for any more.
Pete, let me just make comment on that. Pete mentioned the number of times we've been to the voters. You're lucky. Every 2 years, those of you in the House have to do a campaign. 11 times in 15 years. I've been involved in campaigns going to the voters. We've gone to our local citizens and asked them to fund their schools in what is arguably the most onerous of all taxes, certainly the most visible, most regressive, property taxes. 11 times, 15 years, I have business cards upstairs printed with my name professional baker. And I think that's probably closer to the truth of where I've spent most of my time. This has to stop.
Each year, our school district prepares a five-year forecast to help the board and community better understand the implications of budget decisions. This slide shows the latest forecast that includes an operating levy that is only $6 below the maximum allowed. The two major assumptions that are included in the forecast are that the foundation formula increases by 2% annually and that new money on salary schedules is kept at the same level. No new programs are contemplated. Even with these modest assumptions, White Bear Lake cannot maintain what is currently offered to our students. Major program reductions will need to be necessary in the final 2 years of this five-year forecast. The key to the five-year forecast also is that the operating levy that our community approved last November was for 5 years. So this is the exact window that mirrors the operating levy authority. To be successful, school districts must have state support on both the revenue and expenditure sides of our budget.
Here's part of the reason I say we failed miserably at putting together our budget. This is hopefully shooting for mediocrity on salary settlements and using a 2% projection increase on foundation formula. You can play with those assumptions all you wish. If you go back to your home districts and run the same numbers, you're going to come up with a similar scenario. Now, you're sitting in a school district. We're within a whisker of being at the cap, the maximum amount. And I know here my colleagues, Superintendent Warner and Superintendent Hinton, are here in districts that are struggling to pass levy referendums because of an absence of property values. We're blessed. We're just about, we are average in many ways to include property value here in White Bear Lake. And we've been successful in asking our voters to step up. So their scenarios may be compounded compared to ours. Others would look slightly better compared to ours. The point of this slide is that there's a ticking bomb. There's a ticking bomb that's set to go off in terms of public education in our state financially. We have to address this in some way. And what you're proposing is a wonderful step in the right direction on one side of the budget, but it won't solve it. It won't address it in any way. We'll have another hearing here in 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, until we address both sides of the budget.
As we look to progress through this process of ultimately developing a new formula for funding public education in Minnesota, I would encourage that we develop something, a message that is transparent to the public. And I'm going to point out just two pieces of the proposed legislation that will create some difficulty at the school district level because it's going to be misunderstood. The first piece relates to special education. The handout indicates fully fund state special education costs by removing existing caps. Now, we know what that means. It doesn't mean fully fund special education. It means fully fund the formula that we have created. The formula that we have created requires, on White Bear Lake's part, a transfer of $4 million a year from our general fund revenue to support special education programs. Now, I will be the first to tell you, special education is critical. But we need to communicate the information more accurately to our public. One other quick point. At first glance, when Tim got up here and talked about the formula, $5,174 to $7,500, 45% increase is what the average person in the community will see with those two numbers side by side. Yesterday, being the numbers person that I am, I went through and analyzed grade by grade our current situation versus the implementation of this formula. And if you look at the bottom right-hand corner, the impact for us would be a 16.2% increase on this piece of the legislation. Now, overall, the runs show about a 27% increase. This is an excellent process that you've initiated. I would encourage one other thing. If we implement a 16% increase or a 27% increase over a six-year period, that's less than 3% a year on the 16%. That doesn't get us much better than we're currently doing. Just to point that out for you.
This is the area that, as I said earlier, I probably wouldn't address if I wasn't going to become a free agent here within just a few weeks. Pete mentioned perhaps 16%. You picked the percent. You picked the number of dollars that we put into additional funding for schools. That's a step in the right direction on the revenue side. Problem becomes, what do we do on the expenditure side? And right now, I've been seated where you've been seated a number of times, had people come to this very microphone, point their finger at us and say, you can't control your budget. You can't control your expenditures. Your school district budget is out of control. And they're right. And there is very little we can do to control that, other than that left-hand arrow, programs and class size. That's how we control our budget. We have no control over salary. We have no control over agreements. Here's the formula increase dating back to 99-2000 through this next school year, the CPI increase, but just focus it on the right-hand side, which are settlement increases. Now, if you, obviously, we bargain for two-year contracts, as do most school districts. So if you look at the 07, 08, 08, 09, the last two rows, you'll see that our contract settlement just completed here last winter was something over 8% for the 2 years. Note the increase in the formula allowance. Our budget, like all school districts, is composed about 80% of salaries and benefits. The other 20% are for other fixed costs, to include such things as diesel fuel and paper, both which have been highly inflationary. I'll just pick out a couple. In 06, 07, I just grabbed these from some notes I had upstairs a few minutes ago. 06, 07, that difference of 4.15% and 5.05% was $800,000 for our teacher's contract. You need to add approximately another $500,000 for all other employees. That was $1.3 million that we overspent at the bargaining table. We're striving for mediocrity. You're not sitting in a school district that's any different from your home districts. All of us agree to contracts we can't afford, and we have no other choice. So until such time as either the state assumes control on the expenditure side, such as it has on the revenue side, or it gives up revenue control to local boards, you're not going to have balanced school district budgets. Somehow, you have to put into perspective both sides of a budget in order for things to work. Otherwise, the folks seated at this table on a Monday night and at other school boards all across our state, the other 300-plus districts, are going to be struggling with this very thing. Just a few more examples I picked off. 0405, that was one of the 0% formula increases. That one we were, for that year alone, was $2.3 million. And I could, you know, list others that would have a similar thing. It's the elephant in the room, and we're not willing to recognize that it's there. Somehow we have to address giving local boards either control over both sides of the budget or the state assuming control over both sides of the budget. So with that, again, welcome. Thank you for being here. It's a wonderful community, and you're seated in the middle of a fantastic school district. I've never felt so good about transitioning on. This is a wonderful place and long tradition, as Carol has said. And again, thank you for being here.
Thank you, Ted and Pete. Now is the time that the public can give testimony. I see we have a lot of people here from a lot of different backgrounds, a lot of different places. I've heard North Branch, Woodbury, Stillwater, Centennial, Monomedi, Moundsview. I see community members, parents, teachers, staff. I see all kinds of people, and I'm sure there's some things that you might like to say tonight. So there are green cards at the corner if you'd like to speak. I do have some to start with. The chair likes to run her meetings and be done on time, so we plan on being done at 8:30. So we're asking all people to testify for 2 to 3 minutes, keep it as brief as possible. And with that, I'd like to call the first person forward, Jan Hallstrom. Is she here? We'll over the podium.
Good morning. My name is, or good evening. My name is Jan Hallstrom. I'm a parent in District 834, Stillwater District. I have two graduates of Stillwater Schools, 2004-2007. And one of the things I want to mention is individual students, as you look at how the changes in our legislature and the funding impact them, we might think that students don't notice it. But my graduates were 3 years apart, and it was those 2 years that we didn't get any funding increases. With the same teachers in the same school district, our class size rose dramatically, and my daughter had less experience, less presentation, less teacher time. Some of her students in her classes weren't able to even get to teachers to ask for help, because as we make those changes, and we think we're making them in a macro basis, they're really impacting our students on a micro level. More importantly, I have a second grader now, and I have also some foster students in our schools. And one of the things that I think we see is the terrible inequity kind of across school districts. And I really commend you for coming out with a bill that is going to look at simplifying, because working a great deal on the levy this past year, and I have graduate degrees, and the only reason I say that is to emphasize that even with all of that education, it is very difficult to understand and even less possible to explain to the public what's going on with our school funding. If we look at the equity across our school districts and also across our students in every district, just striving for that in everything you're doing, I want to commend and say I think that's important. I have foster kids who are students in our district as well, and some of the special programs that would have been on the blocks if we hadn't been able to pass our levy this last year would have impacted the kids in my home right now, one-on-one reading programs, special education programs. I have fetal alcohol, ADHD kids. And the other thing, though, to emphasize is, as we look at how the impact has impacted our regular students, our funding, the dollars that went for special education, if that gap is going to increase again and we're going to take away from the students who have just the regular needs, I think that's really, I want to see the special education, I want to see those kids funded, but I don't want to see everyone else in the district have to suffer and have it funded on their backs. So I think that's very important. The other thing I want to just emphasize briefly before I end is the importance of the all-day kindergarten, the special ed, or not special ed, but early education. Changing that funding to a 1.0, I think, helps simplify, but I think it also helps from an equity standpoint. But really looking at, I would like to see it not be voluntary, mandatory education. I can see a real difference in the kids that come in and get the advantage of our all-day kindergarten, trying to bring them up to speed so they're ready for the rest of their education. And I know some of the kids that we're getting are not coming from all-day kindergarten in our home, and you can see that it makes a difference just on my anecdotal basis. But I know we have studies in our district and some testimony that's already been given to the legislature on the importance of the all-day kindergarten and getting our kids ready. So I would speak to that change and also speak to the equity across the board.
Thank you, Jan. Mm-hmm. Next is Chris Wendt. I have to put it down a little bit. Madam Chair, legislators, thank you for letting me come and speak tonight. My name is Chris Wendt. I'm a parent from the Centennial School District. I have a 14-year-old who is entering high school with great excitement. Her parents have some trepidation, but she's very excited. And first, I'd like to commend everybody for passing the emergency funding bill. I think I'd like to thank everybody, and it showed some strong leadership. Thank you especially to Representative Greiling for your leadership. When I came in tonight, I was very excited about this bill, but after listening to the superintendent from White Bear, I'm a little bit nervous. When it comes to school funding, my school district has been on the losing side, especially when it comes to referendums. And I'm concerned
Well, first I was excited that this would sort of solve all of our problems, but I'm not so sure. And it can be a long road to implementation. And along that road, we will still require levies, referendums. And that's where our school district does very poorly. As an example, I have a little cheater sheet here. For $1,476 per pupil referendum per $100,000 in assessed home value, if you live in Roseville, it would cost you $172. If you live in White Bear, $204. If you live where I live, $359. And when we're going through the slides here for property tax reductions, one of the words in here is equity. And you have that you would offset $500 per pupil of referendum revenue. And that would be true if you lived in Orono, where it's $117, or if you lived in Montevideo, where it's $434. And I don't see how that is really equitable. And until this is fully implemented, we're going to rely on referendums. And looking at those numbers, we may still rely on referendums. So I would encourage you to reconsider the property tax reductions and to take into account the property tax burdens that our different districts have. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Chris. Next, Chris Knopf.
Hello, good evening. My name is Chris Knopf, and I'm a candidate for state representative for the for White Bear Lake, White Bear Township, and North Oaks. And I have three children in public education, and I can think of no more important thing than to provide a quality education for their future and for our future as well. I strongly support the proposal put forth by this committee. It provides a sound basis for providing adequate and stable state funding while reducing the reliance on property taxes. The excellent presentation put forth by the White Bear Lake School District shows that over that 17-year period, what we've done is we've turned superintendents into, quote, professional beggars. That is not a recipe for success for this state and for our communities here. Minnesota now ranks 20th out of the 50 states in spending per pupil in public schools, according to the National Education Association. Indeed, in the last in 4 years from 2003 to 2007, the percentage of school district revenue that is provided by the state here in Minnesota fell from 87% to 80%, putting the pressure more on the backs of property taxpayers. The stage is now set for real reform in the school funding system. And next year, that curtain will go up. To make the Minnesota miracle a reality will not require divine intervention. It will require real leadership by the state legislature. Thank you.
Thank you, Chris. Next, Roger Warner, superintendent from Centennial. Former White Bear staffer, too.
And former Roseville superintendent.
Thank you very much, Madam Chairperson, and members of the committee. I primarily wanted to come and stand before you and say thank you for all of the hard work, the effort, and the excellent work that you've done in the drafting of this bill. I particularly appreciated the White Bear Lake presentation because it shows that we have a long way to go and much about which to be concerned. But I can tell you in my examination of the contents of the bill that was crafted, it is very comprehensive. And I would not suggest to anyone here that I believe as superintendent of schools that it's perfect, nor do you think that, and that it probably will go through multiple iterations. But it is comprehensive in terms of examination of the issues that districts throughout the entire state of Minnesota are facing, from those rural, remote school districts to in the hinterlands of Greater Minnesota to school districts that are suburban and metro. And for that, I applaud you, because having spent over a period of 13 years as a consultant to school districts around the state of Minnesota, you have hit all of the issues, perhaps not perfectly, but you've hit all of the issues that are there. I really appreciated the presentations from your analysts to illustrate something I did not know, and that was exactly how the modification of the pupil units from its current scale to the 1.0 was going to work out, because indeed we would have all surmised that there was some revenue loss with that transition. And so thank you for that. I would particularly compliment the crafters of this bill, Representative Grayling and the other legislators that worked with you for these features, the property tax relief, the equalization in school property tax, debt service equalization, which has particularly hurt our school district, and several of the other features that are contained in the bill. I do have two concerns that I would share with you, one of which has been previously addressed by a member of our community, Chris Wendt, who just spoke a couple of moments ago, and that is the concern about the referendum revenue offset. We are a property poor school district, not because we have folks who are poor necessarily in our community, but because we do not have the industrial tax base that many school districts do. We had an extraordinarily difficult time passing our last referendum. It took four attempts. When we had a base operating referendum of, I think, if I recall correctly, about $34 per student. It took four times to get that passed. We have three of our five communities are among the top 10 highest tax communities in the metro area. I understand, and I certainly do not want to take away from the Ornos of the world and the Minnetonkas and the like, that opportunity, if the referenda amount is offset, for them to go for another additional referendum to strengthen their spending in their school district. But in fact, even the reduction of that referendum amount in our community, given the conditions of taxes, will not necessarily put us on equal footing to go to our community and ask for an additional referendum. I only mention that from the standpoint that the very thing that I know that you're challenged to try to do, which is to build adequacy and equity, to some degree, may by that very provision be undermined. But it's an issue to look at. The other thing, and perhaps Representative Grayling, you were speaking to this issue in the scalability. I do understand, I think I understand, that if the proposal, the bill, is only partially funded, you are going to, I trust, work your magic to make sure that that funding is as adequate and equitable as it can be, given the resources that are available to you. I would share with you a concern I know that many or all of you have. I forget which one of the representatives is from Mora here. I mean, you would face the same issue as our school district. If we look at a bunch of ponds, we happen to be in a pond, however big, however small, where our water level is very low. All of the other boats sit higher than us. And if what we do is pump into each one of the ponds the same amount of money, when it's all done, I mean, in the increase, if we go up a dollar for you, a dollar for me, a dollar for you, a dollar for me, meaning our districts, before the water level is shut off, the fact is some of our boats will still sit very low in our pond. And so I bring that to your attention in that that is a concern, that equity facet hopefully will be addressed in that scalability model, and maybe it has been, but it is one that is of terrific concern to us, because as far back as I can see in our school district, 50 proud years this year, one-third of White Bear Lakes, but in the 50 short years of Centennial School District's operation, we have always been a low-spending, peanut-poor school district. And I would like to believe that sometime when I'm in the home and my wife comes to visit, and I ask, did Centennial School District ever get to a point where they're at least average with the rest of the state? I hope she's not going to say, no, sweetheart, it never did happen. I have a lot of faith in all of you. I commend you for the work that you've done. God bless you. Pull this thing off. And let's have a better world for all of the school districts in the state of Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you. I have two cards left up here. I'm sure there's other people that are going to be wanting to speak. So there are the green cards that you can sign, and some, I'm sure there's some staff people that will pick up cards if you put them up in the air. The next person is Don Segermark. Otherwise, we'll talk, and I don't think you want that to happen.
Hello. Thank you very much for coming this evening. And I also would like to, I'd like to start off by just saying thank you to those of you who worked on the legislation which was just passed. I am a parent in the White Bear Lake Schools. I do have an eighth grade son going into ninth grade, and I have a son who will be a senior next year. And I've also been actively involved in the schools in many ways, but I have worked on four consecutive levy campaigns. And one of the things I want to thank you for is helping us. We certainly don't want to continue doing levies, but if we must, it makes it a bit easier for us when the language on those ballots it can just be easier for people to understand. That was very confusing, and we do feel, I was also an election judge, and I know for a fact that many people were confused by that previous language, and many people did not understand what it meant. And many people told me afterwards, oh, I didn't know. I voted, oh, I was supposed to, oh, okay, no, I didn't know what I was doing. You know, it's very confusing, and so anything that we can do to make the voting process easier for the citizens, I think, is great. So thank you for those of you who worked on that. I just want to kind of lift up, and as has been so eloquently stated before me, the high cost of running a levy campaign. And the cost is just, there's no way to measure it. There's absolutely no way to measure it. If we tried to measure the number of hours that was devoted on a levy campaign from the superintendent to the administrators to the school board members, you know, all the way on down to the parents in the community, it would be heartbreaking. It would be heartbreaking if we knew. I'd rather not know how many hours we've spent. I'm sure it's thousands. And it's just completely unacceptable for us to spend that much time and the resources, the human resources that we spend. I think it's just a colossal waste of very talented people who really ought to be devoting their time to the mission and purpose of education. We should not have highly qualified, creative leaders with a tremendous amount of you know, expertise in the field of education. We should not have those people spending time knocking on doors, you know, walking around, putting signs up on lawns. It is such a waste of valuable time and resources and energy. You know, so there's a cost associated with these levy campaigns. You know, even when the levies pass, you know, there still is a cost associated with that. Obviously, we all know the cost of, you know, levy failures. And while I am grateful to my community for the times that they have passed the levies, I have also had children in the schools during the years when we have had levies that have failed. And so I can tell you, you know, that there is a devastating impact. And the impact is felt right away when teacher positions are cut and when class sizes go up. It's something that, you know, it hits home to the families, and it's something that's very difficult. It's very difficult to kind of bounce back from that, because your child never gets to go back to third grade again. They don't get to do that over again. And, lost opportunity there when districts are scrambling and, you know, laying off staff and cutting back on programs and services for the children. So I guess I just wanted to kind of, you know, lift that up. There's just such a high cost for operating levies, and it's very divisive in the community. It pits neighbor against neighbor. I suspect with this legislation going forward that you may encounter some resistance from, there could be resistance from a number of different angles, but there may be some communities who feel that the Minnesota Miracle may end up, you know, taking some of their funding away from them. And, you know, I think once again we come back to perhaps what Ted Blazing has pointed out, that this is a solution that definitely puts us, going in the right direction, and it is helpful. But I don't really see that we're ever going to be in a position where we're not asking the local voters for levies. But if we could reduce that would allow us to spend our time and energy and, you know, all of the wonderful talent that we have in our schools, it would allow us to devote that to the business of educating students. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Don. And you're lucky four more people have signed up to talk. Dan O'Phalen.
First of all, thank you for coming to the Northern Suburbs. I'm Dan O'Fallon, and I'm also with the Legislative Action Committee for Centennial. You've heard a little bit about the problems of our district. Representative Garling, thank you for coming up and hearing us in person. I'll try not to repeat those. Let me just address for a second the real impact that money can have. You know, there's a temptation when people look at these money, and I know each and every one of you is going to get pressure as you move forward in this process, where people are going to say, why are we spending this money? Can you prove any real benefit? Well, let me tell you the story for a second of my three daughters. Like Chris, we're both putting 14-year-old girls into high school with the same sense of trepidation. I also have another daughter who will still be in middle school, and I have a daughter who's now in fourth grade. My oldest was reading at a high level of proficiency in third grade during times of those nice budget years. My now middle school daughter was not reading as well, but the teachers recognized it and caught her up so that by fifth and sixth grade, she was reading in the high 90s, if only her grades still reflected that. My youngest daughter, however, was in the bottom 10% in second grade. And we relied upon the schools at that point to do what they could, but they simply didn't have the funding. In third grade, we knew what was coming. In our district, we have wonderful teachers, and they work our kids hard, and fourth grade is a pivotal year. In fourth grade, you simply have to read. And so we actually went to Huntington, and we spent $8,000 that year and her effort to get her up to where she needed to be. And by the end of the year, she was up to reading probably in the 30 to 40% level, and we were proud this last year that she was up in the 75th percentile, which for us was a huge improvement. When people tell you money doesn't matter, it's simply not true. Fortunately, we had the $8,000 to pay Huntington, in large part because our parents, because both my wife and I came from blue-collar backgrounds, and the people in our communities were dedicated to public education so that we could go to school and we could go to law school and we could make the kind of money that we could afford $8,000 in one year to help educate our child. I think it's safe to say that the vast majority of the people in all of your districts and in my district can't do that. So this money is real, it's important, and it will make a difference. Thank you.
Thank you, Dan. Kate Christopher.
I served on Monomoy High School Board for about 8 years, and I think I sort of understand this funding problem. And I agree totally, schools needed to concentrate on teaching and learning and not on fundraising. But I'm also running for the House in 52B, and I'm door knocking, which all of you can relate to. And the question I get at the door is, how are you going to pay for it?
Thank you. Thank you, Kate. Greg Larson.
Good evening. Greg Larson, parent in White Bear Lake and also the chair of the White Bear School Board. Madam Chair and distinguished guests, appreciate you coming out here to spend the evening with us. Just a couple of quick items. First, I want to thank you for $51. I want to thank you for what you did this last session. Candidly, that was unexpected from my perspective, and so we very much appreciate that. What I really like about 4178 is the fact that you're addressing inflation, and I just want to encourage you to keep that. Whatever happens with this bill, keep that in there. That has been the biggest challenge that I think, one of the biggest challenges that we've faced. You saw it expressed in a variety of different ways here by Ted and by Pete. But I just would encourage you to keep focused on inflation. Now, I have no idea, and I try to follow these things fairly carefully, but I really have no idea what, as measured by gross domestic product, implicit price deflator for state and local services means. But someday somebody's going to explain it to me, and I'm hoping that I'll be able to understand it. However, it's great to see something in there in relationship to inflation. The two points that I would make about education and inflation that have struck me in my 11 years on the board. The first, we don't have the benefit of gaining from productivity enhancements like the rest of the economy. Technology has driven so much productivity enhancement that it's kept inflation low in the rest of the economy. But in education, if you've got 25 or 30 or 35 kids in a classroom, you just can't get that same degree of productivity enhancement. So where we have very, very labor-intensive industries like education, if you want to call it an industry or services, you're going to see inflation. And it's going to be higher than the rest of the economy. So that's challenge one. Challenge two, as Ted indicated, 80% of our expenses are salaries and benefits. And what's the biggest cost on benefits? It's health care. That's the world that I live in and day out for the last 25 years. Health care is also a very labor-intensive business. And it drives additional expense into that portion of our budget, which is salaries and benefits. So we see more than the typical CPI. I'm not sure what this number is going to look like, but if it's annually CPI or less, it's not going to mean the same as if it recognizes some of those two elements. So I strongly support your effort to bring a lot of change to the funding formula. I strongly support the fact that you've got something in there on inflation, and I want to thank you for being here. Thanks.
Thank you, Greg. Keith Anderson. He didn't hand in his card, but I knew he was.
Thanks,
waiting.
Carol. Representative Dreiling and Carol and the rest of you on the panel. Carol and I are old classmates and go back a long time. We're old friends. But listening to the news and being very proud to be a graduate in the state of Minnesota representing students here, having graduation rates amongst the tops in the nation, slipping to ninth, is not something I can hang my hat on. I retired Friday from the Mountain View School District after 33 years as a technology educator, most of my time at Chippewa Middle School in North Oaks. And the class size and course offering issue has always been a great concern to me. School boards, superintendents, curriculum directors are forced to take FTEs and put them aside for special ed. School boards set maximum class sizes for core classes, and the rest of us have to bear the brunt of what's going on. And 43, 50 kids in a class in a wood shop is just unacceptable. But I made it. I was able to get through that. And the funding, I did see a 0.5% for career and tech ed, and that can remedy some of the declines that I've seen. When I started, I was 26th in industrial arts seniority. And unfortunately, now there are only 5 of us left in the district. So it's not something that is, you know, we can build on or continue. And in a state where you look at manufacturing and construction, I mean, this is not an agricultural society like Nebraska or possibly Iowa. You look at Minnesota Mining and all the different companies that are here. It's something that I think we could be very proud of where we've come from. Thank you.
Thank you, Keith. I got to hear the longer version of it the other night. Is there anybody else that would like to come forward and speak that hasn't handed in a card? This is your chance. Okay.
My name is Mary Rivard, and I am a parent of a just graduated White Bear Lake High School student. Very proud of her and very, very pleased with the support, teaching instruction, and assistance she received through those middle school and high school years. I also have another daughter who will be entering sixth grade, and we have, up to this point in time, schooled her at a local parochial Catholic school. I just want to underscore that everything that everyone has said tonight has made perfect, irrational kind of sense to me. And that is, as parents, we never anticipated entering the education arena and being pit against friends and neighbors based on economic conditions. We feel very fortunate to have the education, the wherewithal, the resources to have schooled our children and have had the options that we do. What I haven't heard anyone speak to, and sometimes it can get so esoteric or so out there, but K through 12 is such a foundation for who we'll be as a state 5, 10, 15 years from now. And some like to talk about the sandwich generation, and I suppose that's me, having an 11-year-old, an 18-year-old, and two parents who are 83 and 84 years of age. Those parents over the last 3 years have done wonderfully well, but have had to rely on increasing services from healthcare centers, and social services now and again in general. It's striking that the number of people going into these professions are between the ages of 21 and 30 years of age. There are high school graduates. We need to continually think about who do we want to be in 10, 15, 20 years. And these high school students will be the ones serving our needs. Lastly, my husband is an educator in the Harding High School school district, St. Paul School District. And we talk a lot about the visible inequities that exist between schools and school districts within our home. And it might just be that we're pointing to things that aren't really all that important, buildings and image. But what's really important is that we address and live and look clearly at the needs and how they differ between our rural school districts, our inner city school districts, our suburban school districts. We've worked hard to make sure that our daughters are aware of kind of where they sit, and that they're going to be able to hopefully survive and thrive in the society that our K through 12 schools are creating. So this is truly a bright ray of sunshine, a step in the right direction, and thank you. I applaud you.
Thank you.
John Fisher. I live in White Bear. For 10 years, I've had an experience with 24 years in Minneapolis, and I taught in the Moundsview Public School District for 35 years. But I come to speak to you on this, and I think I commend the committee exceedingly. To me, this is a first step in something that has had to be done for a considerably long period of time. And I really want to commend that particular point. And I'm also the legislative co-chair for REAM, and I've talked to some of you on that, Retired Educators Association of Minnesota. And I want you just to be aware that I'll be taking this proposal to our REAM board meeting on Thursday and trying to get the board to support it. But I do want you all to be aware that even though we are retired educators, we are still vitally concerned with education. We are vitally concerned with equity in education and provide, I think, the best we can throughout. And it has been, of course, disturbing to see what has happened in the past, but I commend you for at least starting the movement, I think, in the right direction. Thank you.
Thank you, John. Lori Swanson.
Thank you. Just a couple quick points. It's almost 8:30, and I certainly respect your time. First, thank you for coming out to White Bear and the other two communities you're traveling to for these hearings. We in White Bear always appreciate opportunities to engage and inform our public, our communities, and this is a grand opportunity, so thank you all. They don't necessarily come to see us at board meetings or our other local meetings. So, and as you know, you can always get school district people down to the Capitol, but parents lead such very busy lives, and it's sometimes very difficult to have them accompany us down there. So we really appreciate this. Thank you for your hard work. It's not an easy job, and it's a long, long haul. And just, I'm very sensitive about this, and I think Dr. Blazing and Pete Wilcoxon know this, but Pete mentioned earlier, I just have to get this off my list of things, I guess, is he said that 75% of our community does not have children in our schools. And that is true, but there's a variety of reasons, including an aging population within our school district, and we are all or part of 10 different communities. You know, the baby boom is over, people are having fewer kids, and we also have several wonderful private schools within our school district boundaries and nearby as well. So it's not like they're sitting at home saying, we're not going to White Bear. I just had to point that out. But secondly, I'm here today. I'm a parent, and I'm also on the White Bear Lake Area School Board, and I'm doing that because I worked on levies in 1999, levies or bond campaigns, 2000, 2002, 2003, 2006, and 2007. Some failed, some passed, and that's why there is such a list. But my point is that they are increasingly common, much needed, and very divisive among communities. Community members. Our community members lead busy lives. They don't necessarily take the time to understand the issues and the need, why a local levy is so important to supplement the education revenue from the state. So if there were a way to reduce or eliminate such a great need for the levies, that would be wonderful. As a matter of fact, on our levies, I know Mary Rivard, who just spoke, again, I said people don't come to our meetings in droves like this one. This is wonderful. Mary was the only parent at one of our meetings in 2006, and she was surrounded by, I think, 8 school district people. She was our only person, and we gave her our entire presentation. So poor Mary. But she sat through it and was quite nice about it. Obviously, there's interest in this room for your hard work, and we thank you. The parents who spoke this evening spoke about levies, the divisiveness among the community members, and I just urge you to continue listening to the parents and community members as you proceed. I'm sure there isn't time this evening, but one other point I have is that when the final bill is rolled out and we have something we can work with our communities, I urge you to develop a strong communication plan for that bill. Again, I think your leadership from the state level is very important to help us explain the details of this new framework to our communities, and I would appreciate that leadership. And lastly, I don't think there's time, but if you could give us a sense of where this bill would be going during the 2009 session. It's a funding year in 2009, and there's also a projected state deficit that is quite daunting. So if you could take a moment, I know everyone would appreciate it, but we certainly understand if there isn't time. Thank you.
Thank you, Lori.
Would you like to address that?
Thank you. If people want to hang around for just a couple minutes, I could address that last question, because I think it is, and somebody else said, how are you going to pay for it, too? So next year, we do have a $1 billion deficit and $2 billion, if you count inflation, next biennium coming up. So, you know, of course, we first of all always hope for a better economy. I talked to the tax committee chair last week, Representative Ann Lincheski, and she said we need to push to have this be the first call on the general fund as we're prioritizing things that we are paying for next year. She herself came up with a bill this year that ended all corporate subsidies in Minnesota, which would be, you know, one way to cut funding and then increase other funding. I myself have introduced a bill that some people up here at this table have supported to put the top-tier income tax back where it was pre-1999, back when we had boatloads of money and now we don't. So to put it back, because right now people that earn $500,000 as a family after deductions pay less of a percent of that income than the middle class, so it would be just making them equitable with everybody else. Others have proposed sales tax increases, and we can always look at how we're spending and you know what to do about further cuts. But I can tell you that the cuts that were made this year to Health and Human Services weren't pretty, so I wouldn't want us to go down that road. And in fact, I would like those cuts to be restored. So we have a big task in front of us, but we should always keep in mind that the price of government that we've tracked for the last 10 or 15 years has shrunk from 17% of state and local taxes to 15%. So we are actually not funding our government as much as we were when we started tracking that. So now we are running into trouble. Dr. Blazing did a really good job, and he's the first person I can tell he's retiring. So he had the courage to say this to us, that it really isn't, even though we think of it as a very spendy plan that needs to be phased in, that really, if it is phased in over three bienniums, it's, you know, not such a spendy plan. It's, you know, 3% per year, he said, for this district. So we really need to work aggressively. We do need, I think, a statewide media plan, and we all need to talk about it locally and at the state level, and that's part of what we're doing here and part of what you're doing here. So thank you for that, and we can use all the help we can get, and we will give you all the help that we can give as well. So thank you very much, and I appreciate school board member Laurie Swanson, I understand, did a lot to help set up this meeting along with Dr. Blazing. So thank you very much.
And I'd also like to thank all of the White Bear School District for being the host tonight, especially Dr. Blazing and Pete Wilcoxon, Laurie Swanson, Kathy Story did a lot in making sure people were here. And with that, I'd like to adjourn the meeting.